My guest today on the Roundhouse Making Space podcast is Imogen Heap, the multi-award-winning, world-renowned and much-admired singer, songwriter, producer and technologist. She grew up in the Roundhouse. Well, not this one that I'm sitting in now, but she has had a powerful relationship with the Roundhouse over the last 20 years. Her music has inspired and influenced a huge number of musicians from Ariana Grande to Jacob Collier, and she has worked with everyone from Taylor Swift to Robin and Britney Spears. Her mesmerizing use of technologies that she has developed has transformed stage shows, and she has a large and dedicated group of followers called The Heapsters. The Happy Song and her score to the play Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, as well as collaborations with Clams Casino and ASAP Rocky, have attracted a whole new generation of fans. We have worked together on a range of projects, from a summer reverb festival, a number of shows, and most recently, you gave a spellbinding performance as part of Roundhouse 360 Festival. Imogen, it is a delight to talk to you today.
Hello, and a delight to be here, and an honour to be one of your guests in your podcast here in your final few days at the Roundhouse, Camden.
It is literally my final few days. I wanted to kick off with something a long time ago. I was wondering if you can remember what was the first piece of music you ever wrote and why you wrote it.
First piece of music I ever wrote. I don't know if I'll be able to remember that because that would have been a very long time ago. But something that I remember thinking, well, that's quite good, was a piece that I wrote for school. So at the end of the year, I think it was my last year at my first school, there was like a school choir. And I liked bossing people around. I didn't like singing or doing other things that other people told me what to do. So the way I got around that is by making my own music for other people to do. So yeah, I wrote this piece. I can't remember what it was called, but I remember being quite proud of it at the time. I think it was some kind of Christmas carol-y song, end of year thing. And I wrote it in four-part harmony, and I think I was 11. And I think that's something that... Oh, I was actually going for some kind of competition, I think, because the school was encouraging it. And I don't think I won. I don't remember what it was now. But I just remember being amazed that I could do that, thinking, well, I knew I could write for one voice and I knew I could, you know, do a little bit of scoring and stuff at school with theory prep that we used to do as part of the instruments and stuff that we learned. But I hadn't ever tried to do, you know, SATB arrangement. And I remember feeling very proud of myself that I managed to pull it off.
I'm not surprised. At the age of 11, that's extraordinary. Can you remember, or maybe this is a more general question, when you're writing songs or pieces of music with words, do the words come first or does the music come first?
It doesn't really have a formula, annoyingly. I wish it did. Sometimes something will be written, but I won't know that it's part of a song. So I might have written something in a book or I might have heard a phrase that will come in and inspire something else to come to life. But I'd say more often than not, especially when I was younger, you know, my intention of playing music at all was just to feel calm and peaceful.
Ah.
And just to kind of, whatever was going on in the day, I now realise I was basically regulating. but I didn't realise at the time, it just felt like I needed to get to the, I literally had to get to the piano room. My body was like craving to get to the piano room. But I think it's that same thing of just being present, just like desperately wanting to be present, desperately wanting to shut off whatever's going on and just stop overthinking things, or maybe you're being bullied at school or whatever's going on, and just get to safety and get to that presence and improvise. That's always where I've wanted to, that's where I've been my happiest, and that's where all the ideas come from, is in this kind of relaxed state where there's no pressure, and then you just end up, you know, playing the piano, and then some lyrics might form, and then you start to feel an attachment to the lyrics, like you kind of owe them something, like you want to bring them to life. You want to kind of raise them up like a plant or something, and nurture them into a song, because it's often something that maybe you want to speak about, but you haven't really noticed what's going on in your subconscious, and so these songs will come out. And again, I didn't realise that at the time, but when I look back on some of the lyrics, I'm like, oh, wow, that was about that, or, you know, maybe that was about that. So in the beginning, it was always the piano, and then the voice, and then a lyric would form, and then I would have an attachment to it and want to finish it.
So when I was interviewing Akram Khan recently, he started answering questions to questions that I hadn't actually asked yet. And you've started doing exactly the same thing, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Doesn't everyone do that?
Jumping in halfway through the interview. I suppose I see you as someone who has 1,000 ideas whirling around their brain at any one time. And when I was talking to Akram about this, he said that the only time he felt still was actually when he was on stage. So are you still on stage in your mind, or are you still when you're writing or performing?
I think I'm still, I feel still, I feel, even though I might be excited because I feel like a pull, I feel like there's a natural pull to the next moment. It feels effortless. It feels like you're on a current. So whether that's coming up with the next grand idea that you just, it's like a kind of feeling has surged up inside you, and you there's something there, and you're just releasing it in words that are hard to do, because words are just like such tiny things that represent so many feelings going on inside your body. And you have to like condense them down to these things called words. And music definitely, it just reaches another place that I find words, for me, I can't do. I've always felt like I've never really articulated myself very well. But when I'm at the piano, strangely, even though I'm not saying words, I feel like I articulate myself better. And I do feel a stillness there. I feel a connection to, now I look at it differently. Now I look at it like I didn't when I was a child, but now I look at it like there's a constant, a stillness and a constant within, which feels timeless and shapeless and formless, and that is just like a burning energy, or it just exists. And sometimes you find that feeling emerges, and for me it consistently happens when I'm improvising, but it can also happen when I'm swimming, or if I'm in deep conversation with someone, or I'm laughing, or I'm watching another person perform that's really taking me into the moment, or I'm dancing. And it's just essentially, you feel like you're on the right path. You just feel like there's nothing stopping you, and everything feels balanced. Everything feels content. And there's this slight pull. And I think, I feel like actually that's what maybe meditation is. I don't know. But for me, this concept of meditation has always kind of befuddled me. This idea that you have to like find meditative state, and I felt like I've been looking for that. What's this thing that everyone's describing? And I feel like maybe I'm closer to that when I'm just improvising. Or I think we get into flow states all the time, but they're not extended. So maybe I'm in a bit of a flow state right now, just for a period when I wanted to share something that went over what you asked me for.
No, you talked about some really important things about how we connect and the flow state and burning energy. What is burning energy?
It's this feeling of belonging that you feel, whatever that thing is, it makes sense to you. It might not make sense to anyone else, you know, like a concept for a new system or an invention or a new way to bake a cake or whatever that might be. There's just this like, that feels right, you know, that feels really right somehow. It sits in my body and there's no friction, and maybe it's, the burning energy is always there, but there's often these frictions in place, you know, like, oh, time or money or somebody doesn't agree with you or whatever feels like friction to you that essentially gets in the way of what is constantly always there. This burning energy is always there. That's like life force, or, you know, being alive. And I think when you feel like, I mean, I learned this new thing recently, which I quite like. That essentially we all have problems, right? And there are different levels of problems. You might have a problem of no house. It's a horrible problem to have. Like maybe you don't have a roof over your head, or maybe you do get a roof over your head. Maybe you get a massive roof over your head. Maybe you get a mansion. Maybe you get a whole country, but you've still got problems. You've still got massive problems. They just upgrade or become bigger, or maybe they're more desirable problems, but they're still problems. You just always have them. And so in the morning, you know, when I wake up and sometimes I'm like, oh my God, I've got so many things I need to deal with, so many problems, you know. Once I get rid of all these problems, then I'll get on to what I actually wanted to do. But actually,
never gonna happen.
You never do, because the problems are always there, they're just in different forms. And actually writing a song is still a problem. It's like, how am I going to write this song? But you feel this energy, this flow into it, because it feels right. But it's still problem solving. And then you realise that whenever you solve a problem, you feel great. Your endorphins are up, you have this energy. And it's like, that's what life is, isn't it? It's just like from one problem to the next, from one puzzle to the next, to get you to a place of growth, to the next place, to the next place. And it's not about achieving anything in the future. It's just about that constant of that aliveness in kind of using your brain and using your knowledge and all the things that you're learning. And when you learn something, you feel good. You know, you just, whether that's a good or a bad thing that you've learned, or a negative thing, but you still feel like you've learned something and you can use that information. So I think the burning energy is always there. It's just that we have, at some points in time, we managed to remove the obstacles away from it.
I just wonder if all of those things are problems. I think there's problem solving, you know, like if you're writing a song, you're solving a problem. But I wonder if there's that's a kind of creativity in itself. But there's another sort of creativity, which is the imaginative development or the artistic creativity, where you're actually creating something out of nothing. And I've never thought of that as a problem before. I just thought that as something which is just almost there. Is it just there? And you just have to find it and put it down. Or is it literally you kind of go into it as a set of problems?
Yeah, don't look at it like, oh God, it's problems. I mean, it's challenges, you know, or it's when you're improvising, maybe there's micro challenges. Maybe that's what's so nice about it. It's because you're like, how do I get from this thing to this thing? How do I want to achieve this feeling, or I want to make things faster now, or I want to slow it down. I want to go to the minor. I want to go to the major. I want to go to this chord over here. Like a tiny, tiny, tiny things going on in your head all the time, but they don't feel like it. They just feel you're not thinking. That's what it feels like. But your brain is consistently going, I need to move my hand over here to do this thing. But it just becomes a flow, because you become so used to that type of problem solving that it becomes effortless. And so even writing a song, there's always the, oh, I've got to write, how do I come up with a lyric that kind of rhymes with that, but not in a cheesy way? You know, there's always something to solve. So I guess that's more what I mean, not like, yeah, negative, like, oh, you know, but that's what I feel like if we, even like there's just some crazy things happening in my life right now, which have been very, very difficult. But instead of looking at them like negative problems, oh my God, how am I going to get through this? I know it sounds cheesy, but it's an opportunity to learn. It's an opportunity to get information from this and look at things in a different way. And it really has helped me, but they are essentially looking at it in a way of, if something is stagnant or something is restricted, how to creatively get around that to solve that, whatever problem that is. And the problem might not be solved, but then you've solved the problem that you can't solve it. So then you let go of that and then you move around it, or you go over here. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm going on about problems.
No, but that's creative. What you're talking about is creativity. You're thinking about things from many different views. And just coming back to meditation for a second, somebody tried to teach me how to do meditation once and I thought it was quite good, but I always felt I should be doing something. So actually I find a much more meditative state when I'm doing things that I really enjoy, you know, yeah. Where I'm, you know, even if it's a long walk into some trees, I found it absolutely extraordinary. My mind kind of feels regenerative after all. But I'm going to jump right back to when you're a child. And I might have got this wrong, but I believe you were expelled from school, but they couldn't quite expel you because they needed you to perform at the end of term concert. That might be true or not true, when you
it
maybe
true.
Say it. It is true. But I want to say what happened next. You went to the Brit school. I always think the Brit school, because I know lots of people from Brit school, but I've never asked them this question, which is, was it a bit like Fame and people are dancing in the corridor and suddenly in the canteen, you know, there'll be a dance routine on the tables? Was it like that? Was it quite schooly?
No, I wouldn't say it was like that. Not when I was there anyway. Maybe it's different now. No, I would say I found, you know, a really strong group of girlfriends, but they weren't doing what I was doing. You know, the thing that which brought us together was raving. We went out raving and that was fun. But I don't know if I really found my musical tribe. I did find a drummer that I really liked jamming with. He was called Neil. I can't remember his last name. But we used to sit in a room and just I'd play the keys and he'd play the drums. And it would just be my most favourite thing to do when I was there. And the other thing that was I really loved about the school was that they had all these music stations. You know, like I went to a school before there and they had one music station in a cupboard that was kind of under lock and key. But I managed to get in there. And that's how I learned to program on an Atari computer when I was quite young. But then here was different. There was like teachers who knew how to use it. And I learned all kinds of things about MIDI and real recording with audio, which I didn't have access to before. And that's when I started to record my own voice, which I'd never done before outside of a cassette recorder. And so I found it really supportive. And I was one of the kids that I felt really benefited from it. And I really got helped by a particular teacher called Gary Hayes, who was actually also madly in love with, and I wrote a song about him called Come Here Boy, which ended up being the one that got me my record deal. So weirdly, the school had a very big impact on how I got a record deal because I wrote a song about the man that was teaching me music technology. But, you know, had I not fancied him, had I not written that song, would the trajectory have happened? Would I have got my record deal at, you know, 17? And been independent from that young if I hadn't written that song. I think, yeah, it's not a simple line, is it, ever? I think it's a state of mind, and having these champions along the way, that's been the most impactful thing for me. It's not like the fact that I got a record deal, that was like bad.
Yeah.
I got a terrible record deal. But it was the people along the way. It was the person who worked at the record label, a guy called James Dewar, who really supported me from young. And actually still now continues to support me. He was working at Sony until recently, a new publishing company that I've moved to for distribution. So it's just these people along the way who really bring you through a period of time and help you have confidence and are there for you when it's really hard, which it often was, but you feel there's a belief in you somewhere, but it's outside of the system. It's a people connection.
Mm.
And so that consistency, that was Gary Hayes for me at that school. And then when I went into my label, it was James Dewar. And then, you know, there was another guy called, Nick Raphael came later. And there's just been these people. And then people like yourself, you know, I really appreciate you because you have been in my life for 20 years. And I have felt like, you know, some of the most memorable performances in London, I think I have played the Roundhouse more than any other venue in London. Maybe apart from like the Barfly or something, like, you know, when it's like a tiny, tiny venue and, you know, there's like one person in the crowd, maybe it was a full house after the first 4 years of that, whatever. But the Roundhouse is like a big venue and I always felt safe there to experiment. I don't feel kind of that same safety in very nice venues around London or elsewhere, but it's because of you. It's because there's like this figure there who I feel accepted by, and so have done things which are often way too ambitious, you know, because I felt safe, and you've experienced those where I wasn't quite ready, but you know, we did it anyway, and it was memorable, but not always gone to plan.
Well, I certainly feel very privileged that you've trusted in us, but I also think there's a thing that if you don't risk enough, then you don't fail enough. And if you don't fail enough, you don't learn enough. And if you don't learn enough, you don't move on enough. And every single moment of the shows and the work that you've done with us, I see as a great success. Success is a strange word to use, but it's something that's important. Mm. And if you don't stretch yourself, and yes, you were very pregnant.
and
pushing boundaries that nobody had ever pushed before. But I saw the beauty in that night as the audience did. You left the stage at the end of the evening and you were really upset.
Yeah.
And you probably didn't hear the people in the audience saying, "We love you, Imogen, we love you." Yeah. You know, they were shouting from the audience. And I know that outward recognition and support is one thing and internal criticism is another. Mm. But I think you're so brave to do that. And, you know, when people talk about bravery being an artist, they say, well, it's not brave as being a firefighter or as brave as being somebody on the front line. But there's something where you expose the inner workings of your core imagination, your being, to an audience of 3,000 people or whatever it was, is a brave thing to do.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, maybe when I was just about to go on stage, I did feel like, come on, Imogen, do it. You know, I did need courage at that point. But all the way leading up to there, I was not thinking about, maybe I should have been, I wasn't thinking about the audience, really. I was thinking about, I want to be like this. I want to be able to show this technology. I want to be able to share this way of making music. I know that I can inside me, and I feel like I want to be able to share that on stage because I want other people to see that that's possible. And I have failed so many times on stage and always forget lyrics and all that stuff. But I know probably too much, which I also think that I push myself even more knowing this, but that when things do go wrong, the crowd absolutely love it. Like, they literally love it. It's their favourite thing, annoyingly. So, and that was the threshold that night, because so many things went wrong, including the fact that I was on stage and I literally hadn't even rehearsed half of the pieces of music because I was so obsessed about Me the Machine with the gloves, which I didn't end up singing in the end. You know, I spent literally 2 months trying to perfect this thing. It's crazy now that I look back on it. But I learned so much from that show. I learned so, so much from that show. And I wasn't able to go back on stage for at least a year or two after that. But when I came back, I'd learned lessons from them and I felt really strong and the gloves were great and the system, we'd learned so many things. So yeah, of course it all is fine in the end. I do wonder if it's also, maybe it's not, maybe it is. I think there's something about, because I've recently been diagnosed ADHD and autistic, and I do think there's something about the ADHD-ness which does, whatever that means, but my brain literally doesn't, it doesn't really get phased by failures. It's just like, oh, well, I can do this. And it's already on to the next thing. It's just like, oh, okay, whatever. And then this, you know. But it's the same with anything, same with success as well. I'm just like, oh, massive thing I've just received. Okay, so what? On to the next thing. I'm just like not phased by those big or small things. But I was phased by that one, particular one. And I did make some changes in my life. But that was something I really needed to do. I just think that in the end, nothing is good or bad. It's just, even when something is bad, you know, you look back at your whole life. And it depends how far back you go. You may think, oh, last week, oh, that was really bad, you know, I broke my leg or whatever. But in a year, because you broke your leg, something really positive happened, you wrote a book or whatever, I don't know. And then maybe that book was really well received and it's super popular and that was great, but actually it works out that it was really bad because you had a tax bill way bigger than you could pay and then you lost all your, I don't know. It's just like, in the end, it's just all the same. It's just it's a constant of good and bad and good and bad. And you just have to take them equally, which I know is, I'm not like, you know, zen about this, but I have learned more over my life that, you know, what seems really bad right now, just believe, just know that it's going to be okay. It is really going to be okay. And it's annoying when people say it back to you. They're like, it's going to be fine. Don't worry about it. It's
it like, is really annoying.
Like, no,
yeah,
it won't be fine. Yeah. I've got all, you know, but you know that it will be fine. But it's annoying when somebody else says that to you because you haven't quite learned as much as you need, or you're still not fully embodying what you fully believe, and that's annoying because you see...
Well, that's really important, the fully embodying. What you're just saying is, it reminded me of that funny game. I don't know if you'd play it with your daughter. It's the fortunately, unfortunately. Do you know about that game?
No.
Fortunately, we're going on holiday on an aeroplane. Unfortunately, the engines both failed. Fortunately, there was some parachutes. Unfortunately, only one of them worked. And finally, you get down to landing in a haystack, but unfortunately, there's a pitchfork in it, you know. And it's just... a really fun game to play. But I'm going to go fast forward a number of years, but back a couple of weeks. I want to turn to the concert that you did at the Roundhouse 360 Festival a few weeks ago, during which you presented a free improvisation section, which I want to tell you was absolutely stunning. It held the audience. You held the audience in the core of your heart or your brain. And you could have heard a pin drop. And I've had so many people calling me or talking to me about it, saying it was illuminating because they'd been to kind of free improvisation gigs before and you made a proper piece of art It was a beautiful moment for the audience. It really was. But this was the first concert you had done in 7 years.
Yeah.
Why the pause?
Because the improvisation is what I really want to do. That's what I really want to do. And I think the concert really confirmed for me too that I really do want to do that. Mm. And the fact that I've also heard similar things from people just saying, but you know what my favourite bit was? My favourite bit was, weirdly, it was the improvisation. And I'm like, that's interesting that everybody is saying that. That's a big deal for me because it's almost like I remember I wrote Hide and Seek. Yeah. And when I wrote it, I felt, oh, this is so self-indulgent. No one's going to like it. It's got no musical instruments, it's got no beat, it's got no bass line. It's so like selfish. I just thought, I'm going to put it on there because I really love it and I think it's got something special and I just want it to exist. So, and it came out pretty quickly compared to the other songs. And some people listened to it and they kind of went, well, what's that? You know, and on the radio, people either loved it or they hated it. And I think that's great. But what I discovered was that the people that loved it were my fans. The people that heard it on the radio were just like, what is this? Or they heard it on the OC and they're like, what is that? I want to know about the person that wrote that. And then they came along and then they became fans. And some stuck around and looked into more things, some didn't, some, that's fine. But what it confirmed to me was I really, really, really was just absolutely so sure about that, that I loved it. I honestly didn't care if nobody else liked it. I just loved it. But then hearing that other people really liked it and that was their favourite song and to see the life of that song has been amazing, amazing. And I felt this about the improvisation. I felt like, I know that I can do this, like, but I have to develop a system in order so that I'm not just improvising on the piano and singing. Because I've done that since I was like 3. And I feel like I can make nice things. But I want it to be full sound sometimes. I want it to be able to be beats. I want there to have dynamics and melodies and harmonies that shift and different time signatures and tempo changes. I want that to happen. But because of the type of music that I like to create, it's hard to do that in the moment. And there's lots of people that I've really just looked up to so much who can do that. And they do it so well on stage. I just saw Reggie Watts the other day. He's amazing. Mm-hmm. And my dear friend, Tim Exile, who's just absolutely astounding. So many of my favourite musicians are just the best at improvising with technology. And I feel like I'm just scraping, just like literally starting right at the start, even though I've been doing it all my life. And I started 11 or 12 years ago at the Roundhouse on that fateful night because I wanted to create a system that I could do that with, but it wasn't ready. But now it's so much more ready. And the technology has shifted in music technology so that gestural interfacing with music technology is way more possible. People are, you know, creating things on Touch Designer and changing sounds just using their cameras on their laptops now. So there's so much possibility there, and I'm really excited about all new projects that I'm working on. But I'm basically taking on jobs now that only do that, so that I have to do this, because it's always pushed to the back. And I was so happy that even if it was only like 10 minutes of improvisation, because when you asked me in the beginning, I was like, I only want to do a whole night of improvisation. Yeah. But then you were like, well, it'd be really nice to hear some songs as well. And I was like, yeah, okay. And then I felt super guilty about not doing enough songs. And then not because you told me to, but just in general. So then I really overextended and tried to do this stupid medley, which lasted 19 minutes.
It was hilarious. It was brilliant. It was absolutely fantastic. Bonkers, but wonderful.
Completely mad. But it came out of just desperately wanting to please and feeling guilty about not being able to do all the songs people wanted. But actually, ironically, the thing which people loved was the improvisation, which I wanted to do so much anyway. But those 10 minutes and the conversations with people afterwards and the feeling in the room has just confirmed it to me that I really want to do that project so much more.
So are we going to see more Imogen Heap live?
Well, we won't see Imogen Heap because I think, unfortunately, Imogen Heap, everybody associates with songs that they want to hear. So that's why I introduced this character who is the child in me. It's the spontaneous, like wildly experimental and free with abandon, just go out and make music and not worry about it, not worry about perfecting it. And that's Him Gone Ape. And Him Gone Ape is an anagram of Imogen Heap. And oddly, I've had this word or these three words since I was 18. Because my first record was called I Megaphone, which is an anagram of Imogen Heap. Yeah. And this was the other one. that I had. And I was like, oh, which one should I call it? But I've always had Him Gone Ape, and now it just feels appropriate to just... So if ever anyone sees Him Gone Ape, they'll be like, either, what's that? I don't know. Let's go see. And then they'll be like, isn't that Imogen Heap? But because I'm called Him Gone Ape, they won't be expecting me to sing.
Well, I'm very proud that the Roundhouse was the place where you gave birth to this idea in a big scale. So, you know, it was really fantastic moment. When you're improvising, where does the music come from?
I don't know. It's like right now, I'm trying to come up with an answer for you. And I don't have a prepared answer in my head. I have a sense of something.
You'll have to improvise an answer.
We're always improvising, aren't we?
Yeah, of course.
We're like, unless there's a script, then what you've asked me, I've probably answered in various different ways, but I don't remember verbatim. So, but I'm trying to describe, it's that feeling in the back of your head that you kind of know kind of what you want to say, and you're just letting it through.
Yeah.
And with the piano, with improvisation, it's the same. There's this kind of feeling inside, which it's hard to put words to, but it wants to come out. And it's like a continuous thread that you're releasing in the same way that I don't know all those words that I just said, and I can't actually remember what I just said, but hopefully they made sense. And it's just, it is a kind of channeling, right? Because I'm not thinking before I speak, even though I should be, you know?
I do know, and channeling what is the really interesting question. Kay Tempest on stage here recently, he said that he kind of channels through the music or the words. They come to him and they come straight through. But I'm going to jump into the naughty quickfire round, if that's okay. First job.
First job. I've never had a job. This is my job. No, I had one job. That's not true. I had a job that I actually got paid for. When I was 17, I went to America and I produced and wrote a song for an artist called Wendy Moten in Detroit. That was my first ever job. And I think maybe my only... Well, I mean, obviously I've had jobs in music, but that was my first actual job.
Wow. Compared with mine, we're helping the next door neighbour's farm, you know, doing haymaking.
Oh, cool.
You know,
that
was cool, like actually.
That.
I was in the zone for that.
I did a bit of palm reading, but I was faking it. A faked palm reading.
I think there's an opera in that, the Imogen Heap opera. You know, that would
convincing.
Be fun. Last time you laughed until you cried.
Oh, God. It was at Reggie's gig.
Oh.
It's so funny. He's just so geniusly
funny.
I was literally in pain from laughing so much. And I was with my friend Darren, who, Beardy Man.
Oh,
and
right,
I hadn't seen him for so long, and he's another one I just think is genius live. And he was just howling, and his laughter was making me laugh even more. And then we were just getting some looks, just, you know, when people are laughing too loud, and it was just embarrassing. But Reggie is so good. And it wasn't always, we weren't always laughing at what he'd said or what he'd done, but it's just that joy in genius that just makes you laugh somehow. Like when I auditioned somebody, I think it was Leo Abrahams. And back in the day, when, like, again, 17 years old, I was auditioning these people, and this kid, Leo, turned up. He started to play something, and I started to laugh. And he was really offended, and it was like, oh my God, he's hiding behind his curtains. I was like, no, I really like it. And he was like, well, why are you laughing? I was like, no, because I like it. So it's that when something connects with you so much, it just feels so joyful. And at the same time, he is also very funny.
So that's about connection. I think that's absolutely great with people around you as well. Okay, your favourite music artist of all time?
Oh, God. I really have to say... I think I have to say Tim Exile.
Wow.
Not because of his music necessarily. And that sounds a weird thing to say. But I find him so deeply inspiring... His method, his what he's created over the years, his vision, his way he sees the world, the way his brain works. I just find him endlessly inspiring. And I do love his music as well. I love going to clubs where he's playing, or if he's got this new venue called the Apiary on Hackney Road, and he just puts these events together, and he's just great. And people are in the room, we're all like total nerds. I'm like less of a nerd compared to all those guys. And we're just watching what he's doing with just jaws on the floor still. Actually, the first time I ever saw Tim Exile was at the Roundhouse.
Yeah, because we had a
John
big...
Hopkins.
Yes.
And it
right.
changed my life seeing him play. I just was like, how is that possible? And it made me want to create the gloves. It made me, you know, for Reverb Festival that we did together on that fateful night, leading up to that fateful night, I curated this evening of improvisation. And I bought Pekka Kosisto, the violinist, who's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just all these people that are improvising. So Arve Henriksen was there, I think. And then Tim Exile. And then I tried to do my bit. It was just so embarrassing. I was just so not ready. It was awful. But anyway, that was the beginning of Him Gone Ape. So yeah, I would say Tim Exile.
Well, that's a great choice. Okay, so this is a big question, but remember, this is a quick fire round because this could be the answer for the whole day. If you were Prime Minister for the day, what would you do for music and the arts and young people?
I would like to actually run for Minister of Culture, if the Green Party get in, just having to say that out loud. God, there's so many things I would do. But to be honest, I know this sounds really self-promotey, I would do what I'm doing right now, but I would just do it with loads more money. I believe that the future of our culture in general is around good data around the pieces that we make to help them be better discoverable, to be able to connect all the people who've made that piece of work and or that piece of music or whatever that is. I would encourage a system where that's the ground layer, who to pay, what did they do, what instruments did they use, all the information that provides people the ability to build systems and a marketplace on top to find what they need when they need it. I think so many of our issues are all boiled down to the fact that we don't have an open database of works that is truthful and has all you need to do. And once you have that, there are so many things you can build on. Mm. Even if you're 15 and you've just written a new song, you want to know that it's protected. So you put it up and you put all the information there. It's there to be discovered. There might be, I imagine there would be music services that only want to hear music that has never been released, or it's only by written by people in London at a certain age group or who have specific interests. I think we can build really curated kind of smaller scale services to help us build worlds around people, around the communities that are finding it hard to form because there's so much noise and there's no real spaces to convene. So I feel like, and actually Tim talks about this a lot, is about small spaces, you know, and I consider the Roundhouse, I know it's massive, but in that sense that it's like a tangible community and it supports, you know, it's local community and it supports the arts and it supports people who want to be able to come through. And I feel like this kind of technology and framework can do that on a massive scale, but still be decentralised in time, and it should be free, it should be non-profit. And I think that actually, not just for music, not just for art, not just photography, but for actually everything. I feel like the internet of people and internet of things, if we can describe these things for what they really are, then we can build things on them. We can actually shape marketplaces based on what people want to hear. So people might decide, oh, I only want to hear music that's supporting Palestine. Well, I only want to hear music that is supporting nature positive initiatives. So you might choose tracks that are particularly funding maybe Earth Percent, or another one might be supporting Choose Love. And I think we need to be able to build these systems so people can easily direct any money, because not only does it help, you know, these charities, but it also helps people discover and showcase things that are interesting to them that radios can also support. You know, let's only play music today that supports this initiative that's really in need of help right now. And therefore, whether you're 15 years old and you're just starting out, or whether you're like massive superstar, you have an equal footing to be able to be played on that radio station, because actually it's not about how big you are, it's about what you're choosing to do in the world.
I'll vote for you.
Thank you.
You've got the vote.
Good.
This is, you know, maybe the next step is politics. You sound like a little bit of a manifesto there. Okay, I love this phrase, which is, you don't measure your life by the number of breaths you take, you measure it by the number of times your breath is taken away. When was the last time your breath was taken away?
Oh, these are lovely questions. I mean, I don't know, I'm listening to a book at the moment, which is by Yuval Noah Harari, and it's called Nexus. I'm deeply involved in it, and I'm very grateful for his insights and deep thought on the subject around AI. I think it's written in 2024. Yeah, it's just really helping me shift focus. Sometimes we think this is the thing, but actually this could be the thing. And as I'm developing my own ideas and systems around AI, ethical AI, AI agents that are built around real conversations with families that are not being pushed out into the bigger models, but are there to protect you and help you create and get the most out of your human time on Earth. Yeah, I feel like there's something in that, how he describes the book, which is softly taking away my breath.
That's a nice phrase, softly taking away my breath, because that feels like it's not so impactful, but it might be in time. So I have so many more questions, but nearly run out of time. I've had so many questions about the Mimu gloves, your entrepreneurialism, your creative passport, AI Mojen, blockchain, but everyone knows some of that already. I've been trying to ask you questions that maybe other people wouldn't ask. I even had a question that related to Mozart and Beethoven, but we will go into that next time we meet. As it's the Roundhouse's 20th anniversary coming up on the 1st of June, which is also my last day here after 27 years, I wanted to ask what the Roundhouse has meant to you and what it has meant to your career as well.
Yeah, I think, so 20 years, and I played there 20 years ago, and I think I've played there four or five times. And each one has been very memorable, particular moments. And I feel there is, it's not just a venue, it's an ethos. It has strength that's deep and it has integrity. It's not afraid. And it's also, I don't know if this is going to go down the wrong way. It's not trying to be cool. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it is cool, but it's not trying to be cool. And I like that. That anything can come there. And it's not like, oh, I've got to do it this way because, oh, it's that venue, you know, you're going to be this way. It's just, there's nothing that decides what you should do on the stage. It feels open to be playful and to be yourself. That's how I find the Roundhouse. And also, the Roundhouse is, you know, I've been on that strip in Camden for so long, since I was 17, the Barfly and all these places. And so Camden has just got, I see myself as this lanky 17-year-old, or even like 15, you know, dyeing my hair purple for the first time, Camden Lock and all that stuff. It has this continuation in my life. And I'll always look at it fondly and hope that I do more shows over my life in the future. Like maybe I'll still be playing there when I'm 100. What kind of crazy stuff will I be doing when I'm 100? So yeah, it represents safety and freedom and support. And I'm deeply grateful for you and for it.
Well, it's a great honour to have worked with you over these last 20 years. And I imagine that when you are performing here, when you're 100, you're going to be breaking new ground, inspiring, innovating, being an entrepreneur in many creative and technological ways, and you'll be leading the way as always. But thank you for today, for making space with me on this podcast, and for all that you've done for the Roundhouse, with the Roundhouse and with me. It's a great honour, and thank you very much, Imogen Heap.
Thank you.